As News Corporation, publisher of the News of the World, has again this week been making the news rather than reporting on it, Steve Hewlett profiles the man at the centre of that story, the octogenarian media mogul Rupert Murdoch.
A newspaper can create great controversies, stir up arguments within the community, discussion, can throw light on injustices, just as it can do the opposite. It can hide things and be a great power for evil.
How true. Although it's hard to imagine that Rupert Murdoch, speaking there nearly 50 years ago, ever imagined himself at the centre of quite such a firestorm of public and political protest. In a little under just 2 weeks, he's closed the News of the World, been forced to pull out of the biggest deal of his entire career, and now, with some of his US operations getting the FBI treatment, faces losing control of the global media empire he has built almost single-handedly from scratch.
This is the challenge the likes of which he has never faced. I really don't think that he knows what to do.
Biographer Michael Wolfe. History tells us that Rupert Murdoch is a man who relishes a challenge. It's been a business career dominated by extraordinary buccaneering risk-taking and ultimately extraordinary rewards.
One of the reasons he has newspapers, one of the reasons he loves them so much, is that they give him an enormous amount of power. You cross him and he will use his newspapers to punish you. That is part of the problem right now. And so that weapon has been taken away from him. He thinks he will live forever. He won't. He is an old man, and I'm just not sure he has the resources to rise to this occasion.
If true, that would be quite a turn-up, since right from the start, personal resources are not something Rupert Murdoch has ever appeared to lack. Variously described as charming, witty, self-deprecating and loyal, he is also widely seen as ruthless, calculating, manipulative even, and obsessively interested in personal and political gossip. Fiercely anti-establishment, but craving acceptance. But in business terms, it's his appetite for gambling that really takes the eye. So where did all that come from? William Shawcross has written a biography of Murdoch and knows the family well.
I thought that he was an extraordinary mix of his two grandfathers. On his father's side, his grandfather was a very dour Church of Scotland minister who had emigrated to Australia, very strict and rigid. And on his mother's side, his grandfather, Rupert Green, was a very rollicking, swashbuckling gambler who spent most of his time drinking at Melbourne's racetrack and was a charming figure and great fun. And so in Rupert, you have these two personalities combined.
Murdoch's first brush with Britain came back in the 50s when his father, Sir Keith Murdoch, of whom more later, sent him to study at Oxford. But even then, the young Rupert was showing anyone who cared to notice what you might call signs of things to come. Veteran Labour MP Gerald Kaufman was a college contemporary.
There was this rule against canvassing for office in the Labour Club. But with Rupert, if he wanted office, he was going to try and make sure he got it. One of his supporters used to send out letters through the inter-college mail with "rooting for Rupert" written on the back. Complaints were lodged against him, and I had to set up a tribunal of inquiry, which Rupert called the Bloody Tribunal, and Rupert was unseated as secretary.
Murdoch's time in Oxford also coincided with the death of his father, Sir Keith, himself a journalist and newspaper man, but most importantly, in a curious pre-echo of the way Rupert's children regard him, the man Rupert most wanted to please. The Murdoch matriarch, Rupert's mum, Dame Elizabeth, still going incidentally at 102, speaking some years ago.
He's a modern edition of his father, and we all know that the world's changed a great deal, so I suppose you'd say that you would hardly recognise the sort of newspaper man Rupert's become. But basically, I'm sure that all his strength stems from his father's inspiration and his tremendous respect for him.
His father might have been his inspiration, but Rupert's ambitions were of a different order. Wherever he saw, or even sniffed, wealthy, comfortable incumbents, Rupert Murdoch saw opportunity. As we shall see, that's always been his MO, but it was characteristic of many of his business targets that they failed to take him seriously, or in some cases, see him coming at all. This was true even in his home territory down under, as he was the first person to set up an all-Australian national newspaper.
Do you think it's possible that people have underestimated you?
Yes, I think so. I don't know whether it's a point of underestimating me so much as just misjudging the situation. They had it pretty easy themselves, and they didn't see these opportunities because they weren't looking for them.
And so began the building of the Murdoch Empire. From his father's newspaper, the Adelaide Advertiser, which he revolutionised, Murdoch struck out across Australia, borrowing to buy. They all said it would never work, but it did. But it wasn't going to stop there, and soon he was looking to the other side of the world, back to the old country. Plenty of wealthy, comfortable establishment incumbents there, rich for the picking. His first conquest, the venerable News of the World, in 1969. And no sooner had he got his hands on it than he started to make waves.
They tried to keep this girl's name secret, but suddenly everyone knew it. Christine Keeler, the girl who sparked off a drama of government scandals, spying, intrigue and even death.
Murdoch positioned the paper as a champion of the ordinary people, rubbing salt into the establishment's wounds, reheating a story which had it all.
I was young and naive then, but now I've had time to think.
The kiss and tell was to prove a staple of tabloid fare, and not just Murdoch's. But for all that she's always supported her son as a worthy heir to his esteemed father, Sir Keith, Dame Elizabeth always had reservations about this aspect of Rupert's business. Australian writer David Laser actually discussed it with her.
She's aware of the fact that he is described as the dirty digger and the beast of Wapping, and she says she's sorry about the fact that he gets cast in this light. And she said, well, I think the invasion of people's privacy is the worst thing, because from that comes so much more. I think privacy is anybody's right. I really do. And I said to her, well, presumably you tell Rupert that, don't you? And she said, we've had it all out over the years, and she's not been able to prevail.
Meanwhile, Rupert was making his presence felt, not so much in terms of political influence, that was mostly all to come, but on the shop floor. Derek Jameson was editor of the News of the World.
He would walk along Fleet Street with a raincoat over his arm and just wander into the News of the World without telling anybody he was coming. And I would get a whisper, Rupert's here. And a sort of shockwave would run through the organisation. And I remember one occasion, where is he? He's in the composing room. He was talking to one of the compositors about gardening. That's the kind of person he is.
And he never, to this day it's said, lost interest in what his favourite tabloid papers were saying. A fact which might end up proving tricky.
He's a very tough, ruthless proprietor. The idea of him allowing his editors independence is a joke. He would phone out from anywhere in the world, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he'd say, what's that bloody rubbish you got on the front page? If I've told you once, I've told you 100 times, we don't want pop stars on the front page of the News of the World.
Having upset the apple cart amongst Britain's tabloid press-owning establishment, turning the Sun into a soar-away success, replete with page-three lovelies in the process, Murdoch turned his attention to the other end of the market, buying the Times and Sunday Times in 1981. Paradoxically, given what was about to happen, Murdoch had initially enjoyed good relations with the all-powerful print unions. But it wasn't to last. In 1986, with a typically audacious move out of Fleet Street to a brand new non-union plant in East London, and the help and support of his political heroine Mrs. Thatcher, the Battle of Wapping began.
Person has been charged to the ground by the police horses.
Yeah! Oh, people are calling it Murdoch's cavalry. I mean, it's dreadful what's happening.
Murdoch's eventual victory over the print unions was momentous and is now widely regarded as having extended the commercially useful life of the entire British press by decades. But it wasn't just the press establishment Murdoch challenged. There was an even grander and, if anything, more comfy and self-satisfied crowd over in television. So began Sky TV, Britain's first satellite broadcaster and, critically, the beginning of pay TV in this country.
I don't know what you mean by downmarket and upmarket. That is so English, class-ridden snobbery when you talk like that. We broadcast for everybody. We come from other parts.
With hindsight, one can see this as a strategic masterstroke, outflanking the television oligarchy who thought their own output so superior they openly mocked Murdoch's plans to ask people to pay. How wrong they were. Investments into sports rights, movies and digital technology have turned Sky into a financial powerhouse, with revenues outstripping the whole of ITV, Channel 4 and the BBC put together. When it started back in 1989, however, it was a very big risk indeed. Media writer Maggie Brown was there.
At 6 o'clock, Rupert Murdoch pressed a button and he launched Sky Television. It was as simple as that.
Welcome to Sky Television.
I stood next to him. I said, Rupert, is it going to work? And he looked at me sideways He smiled, a little sort of half smile, and he shrugged and he said, "It's a wing and a prayer."
This is a television revolution.
Similarly, over in the States, yes, Murdoch was already outgrowing the old country, more wealthy, comfortable elites sat waiting for the taking. Once again, they underestimated him, as it turns out, at their peril. The very idea of creating a new national network, Fox Television, was regarded by the existing incumbents, naturally, as bordering on insanity. But in the end, and this is beginning to sound like a rather familiar story, they were wrong and he was right. The risks paid off, and now Fox Network is firmly established as part of the American television establishment Rupert set out to overthrow.
As you may know, Fox News has hired Governor Sarah Palin to do news analysis. That has thrown the left-wing media into a conniption.
Taken together with Fox Studios, think Titanic, Avatar, need I say more, the Wall Street Journal, and TV and press interests that span the world, News Corporation is a massively profitable, truly global media corporation. But truth be told, it's still, in many ways, a family business, built around the personality and reputation, he's never defaulted on a loan in his entire career, of one man, Rupert Murdoch. And, as with all family businesses, the question that eventually arises is the dreaded one of succession. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, it's been brewing amongst the Murdoch clan for some time, and has already generated some significant family tension, not least between Rupert and his now ex-wife, and mother of Lachlan, Elizabeth and James, Anna. As writer David Laser explains.
Anna Murdoch became very concerned in the latter years of the marriage about the dynastic expectations her then husband was foisting on their children. And she feared for the whole succession once Rupert was no longer able to run the News Corporation. She was deeply concerned about how it might pit the children against each other, and she was deeply concerned about the fact that each of their children was determined to prove themselves in their father's eye, and this was a very, very tall order.
Rupert and Anna split in 1999, and he has since married a much younger Chinese woman, Wendy Deng, with whom he has two children, which only makes the family and succession issues spicier still. And those questions have been thrown into even sharper relief in the wake of the current crisis, and more specifically, how the company has responded to it. James Murdoch was the heir apparent to his father, but his capacity to take on the top job is now being widely questioned, not least by the very investors that would have followed his father to the ends of the earth. Biographer William Shawcross.
News Corp is the story of Rupert's life, his life and his obsessions, and it doesn't seem to me that it is a company that will or could survive his death. It will be broken up into its constituent parts, and that probably would make sense, because his energy, his personality have created this company. And maybe they will all say, well, this has been wonderful while Dad was alive, now we should all go on and do our own things.
But whatever happens in terms of succession, the extraordinary combination of press and political power and influence enjoyed by Rupert Murdoch is very unlikely to survive him. In fact, given events of recent days, it has in all likelihood already evaporated. And in business terms, as the digital revolution races on, lots of new entrepreneurs and monopoly busters have their eye on News Corporation as the kind of juicy target so beloved of the Rupert of old. In any event, it's quite hard to see how the future is going to be quite as rosy as the past.
Profile this week was presented by Steve Hewlett and produced in Manchester by Nicola Dowling.